talk about the family business. No. What I'd like to talk about tonight is two distinct narratives which shape our tradition, which live in tension and in an interesting relationship with each other, and then look how the reality of these two narratives is dramatically and radically transforming the Judaism that we are going to see over the next 10 years, 20 years, and then reflect a little bit about what are the consequences of that. That'll be more or less the three parts, or the two and a quarter parts of what I'd like to speak about tonight. The two narratives that I'd like to build on and share with you, one I call the Genesis Judaism, and the other one I call the Exodus Judaism. And even though they ultimately become part of one whole, they really are quite distinct from each other. When God says to Avram in Genesis 12, "Go forth from your native land and from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation." God says to Abraham that what you do and the path that I am beginning to walk with you on is a path that's going to encompass far more than you. In many ways, it's not about you. It's about something much larger than you. But the question is, what do these larger spectators or participants or inheritors have to do in order to warrant being in Abraham's nation? "I'll make of you a great nation." But who is this nation? There are two very, very important features to this nation, or which define it. The first, and this is the definitive dimension of it, is that this nation is literally the seed of Abraham. Abraham has to prove or fulfill the tests of a traumatized God. And that God constantly tests Abraham. Even in the words, "Go forth to the land that I will show you," doesn't even tell him where. It's like Abraham is somebody who is perpetually required to make a leap of faith, to somehow help God overcome the trauma of the generation of Noah, to somehow overcome the trauma of a world which doesn't turn out the way God wants it to be. And so Abraham is constantly tested. And he is one of the most, probably the singular most remarkable Jew in our tradition. But what happens is Abraham's uniqueness, Abraham's excellence, in the book of Genesis, doesn't become a paradigm for the way other people have to act. The consequence of Abraham's excellence is the granting of Jewishness to those who are Abraham's seed. Being merely born, regardless of what you do, enables you to be a part of this nation. Not only does Genesis speak over and again about the seed, but very, very early on, very, very early on. God basically does not make a covenant with Abraham, but makes a covenant with Abraham's descendants. It's a covenant which becomes an everlasting covenant in its inception. Now, something could only be an everlasting covenant if there is nothing that you have to do in order to warrant and earn that covenant. If being Jewish required something of you, then God could not commit before the fact to Isaac and Jacob and their children and to the generations that will come. To this land, you know, you'll look at these pages, I'll give you all these sources after. I'm giving this land to you and to the generations that will come. How do I know? How do I know they're going to warrant it? Is there something that they have to do? And the answer is no. If you'll just turn for a moment to, or if don't turn if you want to Genesis 22. Which page did you ask me? I'll get there.
146.
Please. The angel, this is in many ways the paradigm of Genesis Judaism. Verse 15. This comes after Abraham fulfills what is his last test. His last test of faith, in which he declares his willingness to offer his son to God. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I swear," the Lord declares, "because you have done this and not withheld your son, your favored one, I will bestow my blessing upon you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sands on the seashore, and your descendants shall seize the gates of their foes. All the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by your descendants, because you have obeyed my command." It's not because they have obeyed my command. They don't have a command. We live vicariously off of Abraham's achievement. And in many ways, the whole book of Genesis, and I think because you know, I've been speaking about Genesis for years, and I think I finally figured it out for now. Until I refigure it out. I don't want to say I figured it out, because then we have to stop thinking. You know, so. But for now, I think I figured it out. I think I have an answer which is adequate for me today. I also want to make sure that you want to invite me back, because if I give you the answer, we don't need him anymore. It's I'm done. You know, who knows? I might have a new answer next year. Stay tuned. You know, it always bothers us why Genesis is filled with such mediocre people. Right? It's like these are our ancestors, our forefathers and foremothers. Give us a little nachas. Not like, let me feel good about my origins. It's like something, you know, here it is, you chose me. It's like, tell me something. Like, who cares, I wasn't there. Make up a story. Now it's like, what, I make any difference to me? It's like, it's not like it's a counterfactual that I can check, you know? Pfft, what do I care? It's like, we don't even know if David lived. Abraham? Pfft. You know, it's like, what do I care? Tell me something nice. After Abraham, we get nothing nice. Nothing. The only one who seems to be a little, we don't know a lot about her. She has certain qualities of substance, you feel a little bit as Rebecca. Other than that, the book of Genesis is filled completely with a cast of between mediocre to despicable people. That's not me, that's the Bible. At least within our clan. Esau, who's the outsider, he's a good guy. He actually, he's given decent qualities. And it always bothered me. Why? Why do that? It's like nothing is staying your hand. Why tell us this? Like, I feel really great. Oh, I'm so proud of Jacob. He stole the birthright. Whoa. I'm like, so thank you. We really, this is, oh yeah. And you're the descendants of Jacob, with the children of Israel. Thank you. Like, I really feel good about it. It's like, thanks, you know. Because one of the nice things about religion is that it lets you pick your parents. Because it tells the story of your past that you would like to have. And I finally understood, as I said for now, that it's possible that this is the essence of Genesis Judaism. Genesis Judaism is a Judaism which is not earned, it's a Judaism which is inherited. And the notion of an everlasting covenant is reaffirmed precisely through a group of people whom God sticks by even though they don't deserve it. Genesis reaffirms the everlasting notion of Jewishness, because if God stuck with them, we're just fine. It's true. It's true. They're not a model for emulation. They are a source of comfort. And that's the purpose of the book of Genesis. Here it is. I made a covenant with Abraham. And wherever they go, and whatever they do, I will walk with you, and I will be with you. And God turns to Isaac, and we'll just, again, just, and with this we'll finish this model. If you'll turn, please, to Genesis 26, verse 1 through 5. Page 179. There was a famine in the land, aside from the previous famine that occurred in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Avimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. The Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land which I point out to you. Reside in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. I will give all these lands to you and to your offspring, fulfilling the oath that I swore to your father Abraham." You don't have to do anything. I made the covenant with Abraham. And one core instinct of what it means to be a Jew is to be a Genesis Jew. Judaism has nothing to do with anything that you do, and it has nothing to do with anything that you believe. Nothing at all. It's almost as if Judaism has nothing to do with Judaism. It's a collective national identity which you are, once you're, which you join, and it becomes a model of your being. That is, now there's, that is a, an essence of the Genesis Judaism. Exodus Judaism starts with the Genesis model, but then changes. If you please turn to Exodus 3, because in Exodus 3, verse 16 through 22, Exodus Judaism first appears. And the way we're going to do this is the first person who finds the page is going to announce it. This is a very tedious Bible. It works well for a portion of the week, but not for classes. It's like 400?
400.
God bless you. Verse 16, God says, Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to me and said, I have taken note of what is being done to you in Egypt, and I have declared I will take you out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, to the land flowing with milk and honey. This is Genesis Judaism. What do the Jewish people have to do to earn redemption from Egypt? The answer is absolutely nothing. They don't have to do anything. And the Bible doesn't even feel it's important to tell you anything positive about this people. You don't really have to know anything about them. We know about the Shifra and Pua, two, what do they call them?
Midwives.
Besides them, we don't know anything. There's nothing. You don't know nothing about them. They're not. You don't know if they believe in God. Nothing. It's like it's not even a relevant factor because their redemption is predetermined in Genesis 12. It has nothing to do with what they do. It's interesting. Nothing. We don't know anything about these people. Nothing.
They have to leave.
That's eventually. It's okay. I know you have answers, but it's okay. You already know that whenever I say something, just take 80% of it and it'll be close. Because sometimes in a lecture I always... It's true they had to leave. That's true. But again, I got to tell you, leaving a place that is enslaving you after they give you all their wealth and encourage you to go, it's not a sign of the greatest virtue. It's like okay, I would have left. The one thing I wouldn't have done is I wouldn't have then said, God, please, could I go back? Which they did over and over and over and over again. It's not, but again, slavery is no great shakes. But then, another, so, the Bible doesn't, it doesn't even feel it. It doesn't even feel the need to tell us a story. And that God saw their, tell me a story of some people praying or, I don't know, give me something. A little bit, nothing. Why do I hear you? Because the time has come and I remember my covenant to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Set to. You have to realize that sometimes some of the most interesting parts of reading a text is to discover what you thought should have been there and it's not there. That's when you really, whoa, another story could have been there. Something else could have been. Why is that not there? And so the process of learning is very often not just reading what's there, but reading what's there as distinct of what ought to have been there. And yet, that's why you let your mind play. Could you have written another story? Of course you could have. Could you have written a better story? Of course you could have. But then it wouldn't have been Genesis Judaism. And the consistency of Genesis Judaism cannot be an accident. Just cannot be an accident. But here, it starts, and here, right here, in Exodus 3, you'll see the shift. They will listen to you, which is God speaking. And by the way, this is God forgetting that he's dealing with Genesis Jews, because do they listen? No. But anyway, but that's God's fantasy. Then you'll go with the elders of Israel to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, manifested himself to us. Now therefore, let us go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God. Now here too, you can read this and not realize that something very, very strange just happened. The Jewish people are going to be taken. What did God just say beforehand? Please compare for a second verse 17 with verse 18. Does anybody want to tell me the contradiction between verse 17 and verse 18?
Go to Pharaoh and lie.
Go to Pharaoh and lie. What's the lie? Don't answer. Everybody take a chance. Take a look. What's the lie?
That they're going 3 days and will be back.
They're only going for what? For 3 days, when in fact they're going what?
Forever.
Forever. Now ask the question, why lie to Pharaoh? Isn't the whole purpose to defeat Pharaoh? Wouldn't the story make sense that God says to Pharaoh, let my people go? We know this, let my people go. No, it's not let my people go. Why tell Pharaoh a story which would make it easier for Pharaoh to let us go when the whole purpose is for God to defeat Pharaoh? Why say, let my people go so that they may worship me? Here, you see the beginning of a different Judaism. God, or whoever wrote this, wants that at the moment of liberation, that the liberation not be simply a freedom from slavery, a freedom from oppression, but a freedom which will introduce to us a life with God. And even though we're not going to worship God, the act of defeating Pharaoh is the act of replacing one king for another king, and God wants into the story the God who simply stuck with you by virtue of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is now saying, I want in. Exodus 6. God declares it formally when God says, page 420, verse 4, I also established my covenant, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and as El Shaddai, etc. I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners. I have now heard the moaning of the Israelites because the Egyptians are holding them in bondage, and I remember my covenant. Say therefore to the Israelite people, I am the Lord. I will free you from the burdens of the Egyptians to deliver you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm through an extraordinary chastisement, and I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. I want with you some version of what I had with Abraham. That whole part was completely silent. Now you could ask, why was it silent? And we're going to come back to, why didn't God have some of this with Isaac or Jacob and Jacob's children? Why not have some conversation about some religious demands, some religious expectations, something? Why wait to hear? I'll come back to that in a moment. But Exodus Judaism, which is introduced in Exodus 3, declared in Exodus 6, reaches its official formulation in Exodus 19. Please turn. Page 522, verse 4, or verse 3. The Lord called to him from the mountain and said, thus shall you say to the house of Jacob and declare to the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to me. Now then, if you will obey me faithfully and keep my commandment, you shall be my treasured possession amongst all the people. Indeed, all the earth is mine, but you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the children of Israel. What word appears in what I just read, which is completely antithetical to Genesis Judaism? One single word. Good, that could be. You're absolutely correct. That would be a correct answer. What other word is completely antithetical? And we're, no, it's a two-letter word. If. Conditional. Whoa, what do you mean conditional? You're stuck with me. You promised. You promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You're stuck. No going back. The essence of Exodus Judaism, it says no. The minute, the notion in which there is a covenant in which I want something from you, I want you to obey me, together with the desire that you obey me, comes the condition, because the covenant is conditional on you doing something, not simply on you being. The essence of Exodus Judaism, which is when Torah enters into our tradition, is that something is demanded, and that which is demanded creates a condition. If you want God, you're going to have to do something. And the whole world of commandments grows in Exodus and does not grow out of the Genesis Judaism. Now, what our tradition is doing here, and it's very, very important to recognize, is that Exodus doesn't supplant Genesis. It's not as if Genesis is the Judaism of childhood, and Exodus is the Judaism of adulthood. No. It is two different models which live in coexistence throughout the Bible. In fact, the story of the Bible is the story of God trying to get a Genesis Judaism, God trying to get an Exodus Judaism, but a God who's stuck in a Genesis Judaism. God yearns to have an Exodus one, but God is bound by the Genesis one as well. They're both there. And it's not an either or. They become two different dimensions of our religious national identity and experience. Now, I'm not going to go into how this continues throughout our tradition, and you can see how throughout the tradition, for thousands of years, both Genesis Judaism and Exodus Judaism continued to exist. And it's not just a Genesis Judaism. And it's not, there's like moments when each one appear. Sometimes it's like a Zachor v'Shamor where they appear together. But very often, they're just two different modalities that coexist. Let's just stop for a moment here. This is stage one. Are there any questions or comments on this stage one? I'll take three, okay? One, two, I'll take two. Yeah, three. I have a third. Good. Yes, please.
It seems like the Genesis is, you're the people. You're my people. And that the Exodus brings in religion or spirituality.
Religion. It brings in law, religion. What would normally be called religion outside of Judaism. The only difference is that religion in Judaism includes nationality. In other words, it's religion in Judaism is both a people and a way of life. It's part of that religion, so you need to use your terms more subtly. But you're absolutely right. What you would normally call religion is almost completely absent in the book of Genesis outside of the life of Abraham. Abraham has a religious life. He is commanded. His is conditional. He doesn't know what's going to happen, and he has to earn it over and over again. But his earning it changes the discourse and creates a Genesis Jew, which then gets... God wants that Jew, but also wants more. And so the two begin a journey of walking together.
Plays out all the time
and every day. And in a moment, I want to talk about how these two are... I want to speak about how Genesis Judaism is redefining the parameters of Exodus Judaism as we move forward as a people. But I'm coming to in one moment. Yes, please.
Just before you started into the Exodus Judaism, you used the phrase with regard to Genesis Judaism that we joined and then we were in, then we had our covenant. And I think joined is way too active.
Good.
We were just there.
Accept.
We got a tremendous inheritance, but when you get an inheritance, you can either use it wisely and enjoy it.
You're absolutely correct.
You can waste it.
We were joined. Would be. You're absolutely correct. You're, I accept your correction 100%. We didn't join. And in fact, conversion is only possible under the Exodus model. Under the Genesis model, you can't convert, you can intermarry. You can marry into the family, you can't join the family. And therefore, Judaism, the Jews of Genesis are those who are born to Abraham or marry his seed. And in Exodus, it at least even imagines. There is no conversion, but there's people who fantasize. It's like the multitude who leave Egypt want to join. In other words, at least there's at least a kind. But ultimately, Exodus leads to the possibility of joining. But you're right. Your correction is absolutely accurate.
Well, I just want to add one other little thought, which will come in later, maybe, and that is the three possibilities of an inheritance: using it wisely, enjoying it, wasting it, or disclaiming it.
That's also right. Let's hold that, but I'm not going to go there right now. But it's heard. Thank you. Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand that the significant difference between Genesis Judaism and Exodus Judaism is in the Exodus phrase, im shamor.
If.
That's right. If. So I'm wondering, is there an if even implicit in Lech Lecha? It's just that we don't hear it.
No, you're absolutely... The only one in the book of Genesis who's not a Genesis Jew
Abraham. Is
Abraham. That's what I said. Abraham is not a Genesis Jew. Abraham gives birth to Genesis Judaism.
Because I keep thinking, God said, I'll circumcise yourself and your children. And Abraham could have said, goodbye.
Goodbye. No, your Abraham is the only one. And Pirkei Avot is correct in saying that Abraham is, there's 10 tests. Abraham has a miserable life because he's the one who has to help God overcome God's insecurity. And that's like, the other ones benefit from it.
Yeah.
It's like, but Abraham is the one who has to pay that price. Abraham is the Exodus Jew.
In Genesis.
That's absolutely correct. Since I give protection to rabbis. Yes, please.
I was just going to make a parallel to families of origin, that we are part of legitimate family through the Genesis version would be we are born into families of origin. And on some level, we will always be their family. And then the Exodus version would be, and then there are some responsibilities if you want to actually maintain a relationship over time. You can't. It's not good enough just to have been born to these people or these right. people as your siblings.
Right. Very good. Thank you. Now, why is, first of all, it's interesting. It's just, know your Judaism, there's this inner dimension to it. And I find just, for myself personally, that the Genesis, that these terms, the Genesis Judaism, the Exodus Judaism, help clarify for me numerous things that happen throughout the tradition. You don't have the text in front of you, and it's okay. I'll just read to you just as an example. There's a debate in the Talmud. What has to happen Babylonian Talmud Tractate Sanhedrin 97b. Rav said, all the predestined dates for redemption have passed, and the matter now depends only on repentance and good deeds. The ifness of the Bible, finally, you have to realize the story of the Bible is God trying to get Exodus, sticking it out with Genesis, until God says, I've had enough, and then you have exile, which is a combination of Genesis and Exodus. Because you get kicked out because there's a condition, but God promises that there will be an end of days, and that way the Genesis comes back in. And now the rabbis are saying, well, God, gotta tell you, it's been long enough. Whatever we did, debt's been paid. The debt has been paid. And the rabbis say, whatever God wanted from us, whatever punishment that we had to pay, the pint of blood that we had to give for our ancestors' sins, all of that, all the predestined dates for redemption are done. The matter now is simply dependent on whether we're going to repent or not. Are you going to repent? This is what? Then according to this, what Judaism is this? If it's going to be dependent on our redemption?
Exodus.
Then along comes Shmuel and says, it is sufficient for the mourner, for the sufferer, to keep in their mourning and in their suffering. In other words, as long as we can suffer enough, the redemption will happen. What model is that? Genesis. Just suffer. God will come back. In other words, the future redemption is built on the Egypt model. It's God who says, I've heard your suffering, I'm back. Or is the next redemption going to be completely different? You're only going to get out of Egypt the second time. You only get out of it the first time, that get out of jail card, you didn't have to earn. Now you want to get out of jail? I want repentance. This is two rabbis. This matter, these are debated by rabbis of a later date, and then the rabbis say, oh, this was an earlier debate. Why? Rabbi Eliezer says, if Israel repent, they will be redeemed. But if not, they will not be redeemed. Rabbi Joshua said, if they do not repent, will they not be redeemed? How could you make, what, redemption is contingent? What, this could be forever? Forever? And here you see these two models getting played out. This is just one small little example, and I had a bunch of other ones. But I wanted to move on to another issue. That as a result of thinking about this, I wanted to share with you, what does this mean? Not just as a theoretical exercise in our own lives. To see who we are, to see who our community is, to see some of the feelings we have and the loyalties we have, etc. But these two features are now having a fascinating impact on the future direction of Judaism. Why? If Judaism is both, what it does is it creates a fascinating tension within Judaism as a religion, in which the content of Exodus is not of Exodus Judaism is not simply determined by the book of Exodus, but by the Jews of Genesis. You're supposed to say, now I'll explain what I mean. What do I mean? If being a Jew is something that you don't join, but that you are joined to, what it does is it keeps a collection of people who are in Judaism regardless of what they do. And consequently, whether you like it or not, what Jews do shapes what Judaism is. Genesis, once it enters, doesn't just simply create an unconditional covenant. It creates a people who, regardless of what they do, are still what? Jews. Now, when the people sin and see what they are doing as sin, there is no problem. They're not bringing their ideology into Exodus. They're saying, ah, this isn't Judaism, but you're stuck with me. That's Judaism prior to the 19th century. Judaism post 18th century, the major transformation is that Jews begin to radically change their observance, but what's changed is they don't see themselves anymore as sinners. The essence of denominational Judaism is such that different definitions of Judaism determine Torah. Now, some of it comes from interpreting Exodus. Some of it comes from an engagement with Exodus. But much of it also comes from where the Jewish people are. Where the Jewish people are becomes Judaism. One of the more... a major example of it is secular Israeli Zionism, who many of their founders spoke about this as antithetical to Judaism. I don't. This is a replacement of Exodus, but the fact that Jews did it ultimately overturned their desire. It overturned their agenda to replace Judaism, and instead it became a part of Judaism. Now, we are a people shaped by, but we are a religion shaped by what our people do, just as much as by what our rabbis say. And we know that one of our great challenges as rabbis is that we could push you, we could prod you, we could try to make you a little uncomfortable. But at the end of the day, under you, we can't say anything that you can't hear. We can't. And the art of a rabbi is to find that balance between being an Exodus rabbi and a Genesis rabbi. And knowing that on the one hand, you're committed to this people, even though their standards are deeply problematic. And you're committed to them, and but what's really interesting is then how do you reinterpret, adapt, play with Exodus Judaism because your people are there by virtue of Genesis anyway. And it's a very, very delicate balance. And a rabbi who loses that balance either loses their conscience on the one hand, or lose their ability to really be a religious leader. And to be a religious leader is not to declare people as sinners, but to find a Judaism which will inspire them and to hear where they are. But as a result of these two features, if let's forget for a moment where the Jewish people are going. What are some of the key features of Judaism that are being produced by the living reality of the Jewish people? Now, Judaism is traditionally, there's a trinity in Judaism. And the trinity in Judaism is God, Torah, and Israel. That's the Jewish trinity. God, Torah, and Israel. Three key features. And I'd like to very briefly point to what are some of the major changes taking place in, or will be taking place, some of them are, and they're, you could see them, they're just going to become more and more predominant, in the notion of God, in the notion of Torah, and in the notion of Israel. What Judaism are the Jewish people creating? Now, when you talk about the Jewish people, you have to immediately make a distinction. Because since we don't agree about Judaism, there are very different Jewish peoples living very different Judaisms. And I'd like to, I don't think I'll have time to do everybody, but I'd like to initially divide between, on the one hand, Orthodox Judaism, and on the other hand, Liberal Judaism. And let's take that definition as a, there's others, but let's take that as a rule for now. The first thing in liberal Judaism, which seems to be pretty self-evident, is that most Jews don't live up to the denominational rules of the denomination to which they belong. In other words, denominational affiliation doesn't seem to create a strong sense of obligation. Consequently, it's not a huge leap to see that in the future, denominational labels don't seem to be profoundly important to where Judaism is going. Doesn't mean the denominations will stop, but that means that people pick the shul not so much on its denominational affiliation, but mostly because of the rabbi, because of the programming that's offered in the shul, what the shul has to offer, the early childhood program, the different possibilities that exist within the synagogue for personal fulfillment. Now, it's not, oh, I'm reform, I have to go to reform. I'm conservative, I have to go to conservative. Because most conservative Jews and most reform Jews, as distinct from conservative rabbis and reform rabbis, don't live up to the standards of the denomination to which they belong to in the first place. The primary distinction in liberal Judaism, regardless of which denomination you belong to or which synagogue you go to, the primary distinction is between observant liberal Jews and non-observant liberal Jews. That's the primary distinction. The vast majority of liberal Jews are non-observant liberal Jews. Now here, I don't want to go into in great depth the Judaism of the non-observant liberal Jews, because frankly, where is that Judaism going? It's impossible to tell. Because what defines the content of the non-observant liberal Jew is very rarely Judaism and much more whatever the cultural, moral mores of the society in which they live in dictates. Where non-observant liberal Jews are going is not determined by Torah, it's not determined by tradition, it's just determined by wherever they happen to live. And a non-observant liberal Jew who came from the Soviet Union and moved to Israel could be shaped. Their Jewish values are shaped by that. Just like a non-observant liberal Jew who lives in Canada or who lives in the United States, and again, depending on where they live, will be shaped by that. Now, in that context, God might be part of non-observant liberal Judaism, like the God, Torah, Israel. The God might be present, but it will be more defined by Madonna than it will be by Yom Kippur. If spirituality is in, then spirituality will be in. If spirituality is down, then spirituality is down. If nationalism is in, then nationalism will be in. If universalism is in, it's wherever the current of the world is going. Now, what's interesting, since they have a profound impact on Judaism, part of Judaism is locked into a roller coaster over which we have absolutely no control. We're locked into something where it's like we're a missile following something, and where it's going is not determined by us. But let's leave them aside for a moment and let's go to the observant liberal Jew. And again, whether it's a reform observant liberal Jew, a conservative observant liberal Jew, reconstructionist, secular, renewal, whatever type of observant liberal Jew you are. God, one of the features of God in the past, one of the essential features of monotheism, was not that God is one, but that God is radically other. That's the real revolution of monotheism, was not the oneness of God, but the radical otherness of God. A God who is independent of you, who transcends you, who ultimately obligates you. A God whose oneness requires awe, requires fear, when you fully understand that you're in the presence of God. One of the places that Genesis Judaism and Exodus Judaism is going is in a radical redefinition of God. God is somebody who is spoken to but not prayed to. And let me just for a moment, I'm speaking now about major shifts. I'm not attempting to define all Judaism, but a major What I'm positing are the major currents of the Judaism being created by Genesis Jews. The new Exodus. There's other Exoduses. And there's lots of subtleties here and there. But by and large, when you look at the mass of observant Jews, observant liberal Jews, God is not somebody who is the source of adulation. God is not somebody who you feel profoundly in need to praise. Jews, the prayer book, is increasingly insignificant, as is the experience of prayer itself. This is not a God who you feel obligated to enter into God's presence. Petitional prayer still continues, because petitional prayer grows more out of the human need, more out of an awareness of who we are, as distinct from an awareness of who God is. We need to request assistance. Petitional prayer will exist, and it transcends formal synagogue life. The vast majority of even observant Jews, attending synagogue is not a primary aspect of their life. And even those who do, knowledge of what they are saying, the experience of prayer, is dramatically diminished. Successful prayer services need to incorporate music, entertainment, experiential highs, all of which have very little to do with the spiritual engagement of God. God will exist, but God is increasingly insignificant. Definitely not the God of old. It might be a God who you engage, not in a sense, engage in some, and I want to include, because it is there, or at least presently, some spiritual dimension, even though there's very little meat or clarity as to what that spiritual experience is. But there is a spiritual, there is a hunger for some experience of transcendence. But it doesn't have a very, it's not a God of oneness who challenges you, who you feel that I have to enter into the presence of that God. That is an important part of your life. The second part is that there is no God who commands you. Not only do you not have to pray and give thanks, but you also, this is not a God who because of their otherness, sets for you a standard that challenges you and forces you to look differently at your life. That whole, the essence of the monotheist revolution is being removed by the Genesis Jews of the 21st century. It's not atheism, but it's a different God. It also dramatically transforms our Torah. Torah is not the same. And not only is Torah not a commandment, not a system of obligation, the major transformation is that Torah is not a way of life. 613 commandments is not just dead as a model of what you must do, but the idea of 613 commandments is dead. Where does the rabbinic tradition get 613 commandments from? The idea is they add up all the limbs in the body and all the days of the year. That's the rabbis say, that's 613. What is the image? That you have to live with God through every limb of your body and through every moment in time. That a life of Judaism, that a life of Torah is an all-encompassing experience. Any remote association with that all-encompassing experience is long gone, and increasingly so. Increasingly so. Judaism and Torah is not a way of life, nor is it a system of duty, and it's not by accident, as we've said, you know this already, that mitzvah is translated by contemporary, by Genesis Jews as what? What's the English translation of Genesis Jews of the word mitzvah? Good deed and not commandment. Not commandment. What does that mean? I suggest the primary features of Torah as we move forward. And here, I'm just describing. Sometimes it might be a more total description. Sometimes it might be a little smaller. And I'm not evaluating. I'm just describing for now. There will be, there are, and increasingly will be, two primary aspects to Torah. The first is cultural ritual. Cultural ritual is people will engage, that the observant liberal Jew, the purpose of Torah is not the worship of God. The primary purpose of Torah is either a connection to one's people, a connection to one's past. It's a language, cultural vocabulary. The primary carriers of it will be the Jewish calendar. Synagogue life is in many ways one of the paradigms of this cultural vocabulary. I come to shul, I speak in a language of a tradition, I engage in an experience, a bar mitzvah, a wedding will be done in a certain way. There's going to be new cultural expressions of this, and Mark pushes it all the time. What are the ways in which you culturally express Judaism? It could be through synagogue, it could be through the life cycle, it could be through calendar, and it could be, you know, through art, music, film, etc. But the primary carrier, when someone does Torah, what they're doing is they're engaging in a cultural expression. And through that, the primary purpose of a cultural expression is as a vehicle of identity building. That's one dimension. The second dimension of Torah is as a value language. And I'm saying very clearly, value language, not value observance. It's a value language. Torah will be mined, not M-I-N-D, M-I-N-E-D, is increasingly being mined for which values we are going to see as carriers of a Jewish vision, Jewish excellence, Jewish mission. A dual feature of Torah as culture and values. Now, for the non-observant liberal Jew, Judaism's values are whatever their cultural ambiance teaches. The observant liberal Jew engages in a conversation with the past and builds a Judaism whose primary building blocks are, in addition to culture, value foundations. Values which make one feel proud, values which make one feel that Judaism is contributing, that Judaism is making you a better person. And a better person could be morally, spiritually, it's not just ethics. But that this value language, and it is more than just what you do, it's a way that you talk. It's a way that you talk. And I'm going to come to this, a very strong example of this is what happened with Gilad Shalit, and we'll talk about that tomorrow. What's the way that you talk? What's Jewish? Like, that's not a feeling, oh, that's not Jewish. It's a thicker dimension for the observant liberal Jew. Now, obviously, there are different levels in this continuum between non-observant and observant. Synagogues are primarily carried both by the observant and by the very observant. Populated very often by the non-observant through the bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah ritual. Either through their own or through attending your friends. And one of the great difficulties that rabbis face is how do you run a service for non-observant Jews? It's a very... And I almost wish every one of you, every Jew should take turns having to sit on the pulpit and to watch the what you look like. Not you necessarily. What it's like to have to run a service for you. Not you. Not you. No, I'm not saying you, but I'm saying the Genesis Jews of the world. The synagogue, what?
I've seen some of them.
You've seen some of them. I'm being, you know, really polite. The range of emotions of your facial expressions in synagogue while you are praying ranges somewhere from... That's the range. And when the rabbi goes like this, you go. A notion that there's a book, that there's a word, that there's a tune that you might learn. It's not even in your vocabulary as something. Why? Because you're a Genesis Jew. It's not for me. But Torah, now it's in God, these three, God is transformed. Torah is primarily a cultural identity expression and a value language with ranges of observance. Ranges of observance. And increasingly, it's the observant liberal Jew has great difficulty with the non-observant liberal Jew. And one of the interesting challenges that synagogues face is how do you create mediums of experiences for such broad spectrums of Jews? How do you do that? And but now we come to Israel. Israel also is dramatically being transformed. The first is, as you know, who is Israel, is being completely rewritten. Who is Israel is the opposite of Israel's law of return. Israel's law of return states that whomever Hitler would kill is Jewish. In other words, it's a definition of Jewishness as determined by others. The new definition of Israel, which already is here and it's just becoming more and more entrenched, is a completely volitional one. Who is Israel is almost anybody who sees themselves as Israel. A Jewish father, a Jewish mother, married to a Jew. Anybody who sees themselves, whether they went through conversion, whether they were born, it's irrelevant. And in our community, Israel is becoming, and I'm talking about the community in North America, Israel is becoming, from a from the Genesis model of being joined, the paradox is that even though I'm in a Genesis model, I'm reshaping Exodus to define that who's in? Anybody who declares themselves and sees themselves as in. But what Israel means is being even more deeply, not just in its context, is being in its meaning, is profoundly going to change. Israel, under the Genesis model, created a strong sense of Judaism ground to an ethnic family. And the purpose of Israel was to create a particular identity. The future of the meaning of Israel will only exist to the extent that any particularity will be allowed only to the extent that it doesn't undermine the universal. If particular identity creates a block between you and the universal, then that particular will be removed. Particularity, Israel, if you want to, it's, you see it more in Canada than here, but where multiculturalism is much more serious. But the idea of, I could have my particular identity, when my particular identity from the beginning is seen as one aspect of a richer tapestry. And my particularity, just like any piece of a tapestry, any thread in a tapestry, enriches the larger tapestry. And I could feel proud of my particularity. But my particularity is where I come from. It doesn't define my sphere of identity. I come from a place, but who I come from is the calling card through which I engage with others in a richer conversation. This is the essence of multiculturalism. Israel as an aspect of multicultural universalism is what peoplehood, is what Israel is increasingly becoming. In Israel, which is us and not them, is a language which will, in my estimation, disappear in the very near future, and it has already disappeared. For example, now let's take Israel, not just Israel as Jewish people, let's take Israel, the state of Israel. If Israel is that which separates you from the world, then Jews will separate from Israel. If Israel is that which separates you from your value narrative, then you will separate from Israel. Because the value narrative, actually both Torah, becomes a perfect vehicle through which peoplehood gets redefined. My culture, cultural ritual and vocabulary, becomes a rich way for me to engage in a world. The non-Jew gets to see or participate in my chuppah or in my bar mitzvah. You know, these are our culture. Well, you have your cultures, I have mine. But my cultural expression gives me identity, but it is a bridge for a relationship with you. Because it's the way that you see me. It's like, and you actually appreciate me. And I contribute to you by me being particular. Similarly, my value vocabulary becomes one of the key features of my relationship and way in which I improve the world. Tikkun Olam is not just tzedakah. Tikkun Olam starts by saying, how do we think about things? What's a Jewish lens on issues of social justice, on issues of universal health coverage, on issues of war, on issues of rights of minorities, on issues of the other, on issues of gays and lesbians, on issues of single, all of them, what's the lens? What type of values did we mine our tradition? And they become the vehicle through which we talk. Now, when Israel undermines my sense of value, excellence, and aspiration. Or when Israel becomes that which will make me break from the world, then we will drop Israel. Jewish peoplehood, Israel could continue, but only as an integral part and not as a counter to my connection to the world. If we start with Abraham, Abraham was called the Hebrew, Ha'ivri. And in the rabbinic tradition, the model, the notion of what does it mean to be Ivri, the word Ivri means not also means side. Abraham was Ever, was on one side, and everyone else was on the other side. That modality, which was so central to the biblical narrative, to the rabbinic narrative, to the medieval narrative, to the anti-Semitic narrative, is being completely overturned by the new exodus of Genesis Jews. And so if we just look at the liberal community, the three core features of Judaism that we see are being redefined as we speak. Now, the world of predictions is always difficult, because who knows what will happen tomorrow to create a different five-year plan? Anti-Semitism could return, and that could change everything. A lot of things could happen. But if we look at the major currents in Jewish life, this seems to be the new Judaism that we are going to be encountering. One of the interesting questions is whether this Judaism is sustainable. Whether this Judaism will sustain itself or not. But one of the features of being a people who are Genesis Jews is that we don't get to decide whether this is Judaism on the basis of whether it's sustainable. This is what we're going to have. This is already, in no small measure, what we have. Like one example, and I've mentioned this to you in the past, I had a debate once with a very prominent, a very prominent sociologist in Jewish life, who had assessed the consequences of intermarriage. And he looked at every single parameter of observance and found that it is profoundly altered in intermarried families. Every single parameter. And as a result, he said, and he's a liberal Jew, we have to wake up and recognize and declare intermarriage as the greatest cancer facing Jewish life as we move forward. And he got up in front of 150 rabbis in the summer and he said, I want you to go back on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and begin the war against intermarriage. And look, here's the data. His problem was, he thought that he was an Exodus Jew. He didn't recognize the implications of Genesis. And I got up and said, it's possible, you know, I already know that the results of sociological analysis are usually determined by how you ask the question, and a certain. So I know it's not exactly the biggest science on the face of the earth. But I'll even grant you whatever it is that you say. Guess what? The Jewish people are intermarried. That's us. And I'm not in the business of calling us cancer. That's us. Welcome to who we are. Does it create a problem? Maybe. Then guess what? It's our problem. The solution is not to say, leave. You don't get to do that when you have a Judaism built on Exodus and Genesis. That's not part of the rules. That option doesn't exist for you. What you have to ask is, so now what do I do? Now in the Judaism that I outlined, I would just state that not only is it going to require of us to be exceptionally smart, And not only is it going to require of synagogues and JCCs, and I'd say you're right, of JCCs and federations and camps, not only is it going to require of us to be exceptionally smart in the avenues of experiences that we provide, it's going to require of us, number one, to be exceptionally non-jealous of each other. Exceptionally non-jealous. Our institutions are going to have a largesse of spirit, which might be counterintuitive and in certain cases counterproductive to their institutions, but exceptionally critical for the future of Jewish life. Because when you have, this is the observant Jew, how you thicken each one of these features of God, Torah, and Israel, and how they become hooks which are sufficiently thick to be identified with, is going to require a plethora of options. But those options, I'm not talking about we need lots of options of low-level stuff. That's easy. What we're going to need to have are multiple options of depth. Because it's not the non-observant Jew who we need to attract. It's the observant Jew. And the observant Jew, the non-observant Jew is going to, okay, we'll do a bunch of stuff. We'll have some birthrights, and we'll have some birthrights. You know, and we'll have bar mitzvahs, and we'll do lots of little stuff to keep the non-observant Jew somehow within the radar. Somehow within the radar. Keep them somebody who we could, but what we need to create are not more non-observant Jews, and therefore more and more programs which all they could achieve is more non-observance, is okay, it's like treading water. Now treading water is important, because the alternative is not that great either. So I'm not knocking treading water, but at the same time, let's not associate treading water with getting anywhere. So I'm all for a lot of treading water, that's okay. But our community has to look at, and our leadership has to look at, how do we create different options of excellence for observant Jews to make the observant Judaism, which as it is a brand new Judaism. It's a Judaism that we've never encountered. Something that at least has sufficient hooks to be able to be sufficiently meaningful. To carry itself. But beyond that, one of the key features of this is that we are entering into a time when I believe that the only secret, or the primary secret, of Jewish perpetuation is going to be based on a reimagining of the extent of Jewish knowledge that is necessary in order for us to survive. The observant liberal Jew is going to have a level of knowledge parallel to the Orthodox Jew. It's a Judaism which has to compete by being meaningful. The distinction between Orthodoxy and liberal Judaism in level of knowledge, if that distinction is perpetuated, then those liberal Jews are going to fall into the domain of the unobservant liberal Jew. It's only to the extent that there is a familiarity with the nuances of that you become a good cultural player. And a good cultural player, whether you're singing, whether you're playing tennis, whether you're swimming, is something that engages you to the extent that you achieve a level of nuance. That's one. But more than that, it has to be a Judaism that creates for you a world of ideas that you can carry with you. And if you aren't equipped with those ideas, and that you don't feel that they are yours, then as you're walking in your universal context, you will assimilate in the deepest sense, which is ultimately what the non-observant liberal Jew is doing. Because what's determining their life is their general culture, not their Jewish culture. To create a plethora of vibrant, distinct options, where each institution sees the other as necessary for them, not as my enemy. I can't compete for membership. And here our problem is not the professionals, our problem is primarily the lay people who think that it's their job to watch the budgets, the bottom line. And then you perpetually live in a zero-sum game, because anybody who's a member in one place is not a member in another. Our rabbis and educators understand this already. But an institutional life which realigns and recognizes what we're confronting, as well as a reprioritization and a discovery of ways to bring levels of Jewish knowledge, Jewish value conversation, to a much higher level than exists today. Those are the challenges which grow out of the Judaism of Genesis and Exodus over the next decade. And how we will respond to them will determine what type of future we're going to have. What type of vibrancy, what type of vitality, what type of continuity, and whether we ourselves, like every generation, as I've always said, it's like, I think in these terms, that we've been going for a very long time. We've had a great run. We really did. We've had an outstanding run. But one of the reasons why we had such a good run is that in every single generation, individuals stood up and said, I got these 30 years covered. I got you. These are the 30 years I'm watching. I'm on guard. I'm gonna do what's necessary to make sure that these 30 years are passed on to somebody else. The nature of Genesis and Exodus Judaism is creating a new arena for us. And it's our job to make sure that we watch our 30 years so that we can have another 30. We stood on people's shoulders. People who had immense challenges. Immense challenges. Imagine the challenge of somebody who just comes out of Auschwitz. The challenge of someone who comes out of Auschwitz and the temptation to say, excuse my friends, shut this off, screw it all. Screw it all. I don't want it. Who needs it? Who needs it? I give up. And they came out of Auschwitz and said, it's my 30 years. And they sacrificed, and they controlled themselves, and they very often chose directions which were counterintuitive, and they said, Jewish people, I got you. What are we going to do is the story that our grandchildren are going to tell. But as Genesis and Exodus Jews, what we don't get to do is we don't get to pick our people. We don't get to pick who we're working with. That's the given. What we do with it, that's the challenge. Thank you. And now we have some time for maybe 4 questions. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, we got the 4. And the 4 who raised didn't ask beforehand, right? Good. So
I took for you to mean when you said observant Jews shouldn't be jealous, that they shouldn't be judgmental.
Is that what you meant?
No, I said observant institutions shouldn't be jealous of each other. Because any Jewish institution which is creating a hook and a thickness for the observant Jew is the Holy of Holies. And if somebody's, and if you got somebody, then you're part of me creating a hole, even if they're members by you and not members by me. Now, that's, we can't afford institutional jealousy, because no single institution is going to be sufficient to answer the varied needs of the new observant liberal Jew and the new Torah that they're creating.
Then what about amongst those groups, all of the judgmental stuff goes on, you're not good enough in my group, etc.?
What about all of that stuff? That stuff is just simply, it's destructive. It's destructive in Judaism. It's destructive in our conversation around Israel. It's just people who aren't reading where the Jewish people are. And they're not realizing how close we are to losing the whole category of observant liberal Jew. We are this close. This close. And it's, if you recognize that, then you realize that the demand of the hour is very, very different, and that you have to refrain from such behavior.
But there's such argument between.
You're just describing. Again, I'm aware of what's there. I'm just talking now to you about what needs to be. Obviously, those are the, as I say, even more, we have to rethink, and we have to help our institutions move in that different direction.
There's such arguments between all the people along that continuum.
I know that. I accept that as the given, but that's part of what needs to change. Part of that. There was a... Yes, please.
You said that when the liberal Jews, we run across things that are consistent with our values, we'll abandon them. If Israel starts to do that way, we'll abandon them. Can you sort of reverse the model and look at it from the conservative side, and then maybe confusing conservative Judaism with conservative politics? But it seems to me that the opposite is happening, that when people get that involved and that conservative, that they tend to change their values to match what they're saying. How does the model work on both sides of that?
You see, most of those people who are doing that, I'm going to speak about this more tomorrow. Their connection to Israel is something that comes from a different place. But that narrative is a dying narrative. It's just simply a dying narrative. And as you get younger and younger, for them, that group of people, as long as you see Israel as that which is facing an existential threat, you suspend the value conversation for a while. But as Israel gets more and more powerful, the ability to suspend the value conversation, just like I said, anti-Semitism will change it. War in Israel will change it. There's certain things that are variables that influence it. But as time is progressing, the ability to make that leap is becoming harder and harder to sustain. But even, and it's very important, even the conservative Jew, though, is not somebody who's necessarily saying that Israel is not fulfilling its moral obligations. But the argument, for example, and I was here, you can see who's at fault for the failure of peace becomes critical. Because if Israel's at fault for the failure of peace, then it's violating my value agenda. But when I see the Palestinians as the one who are at fault, then I am not, there's no moral compromise, which I have. And one of the things that happens is, therefore, we focus on public relations. What's the goal of public relations? The goal of public relations is the enabling of a creation of a narrative which enables me to have a relationship and to sustain my value language. That's the essence of what public relations is supposed to do. But I'm going to talk about that a little more tomorrow. Okay? But thank you. Yes, please, the last two.
Yeah, I think
agree with everything you said. I think you articulated very well. The business of the Genesis framework, I can sort of turn that on its head. In other words, the fact is that it's not only a question of God choosing me, but for I have no choice as a Jew. In other words, I am a Jew. God put me in that situation, so to speak. And with that, I'm sort of stuck with the historical narrative. And that some points that you raised that I just would like to toss out. One of them is
universalist. Just a little louder, please. Yes.
One of them is the universalist idea. After all, that's been a problem, at least within my lifetime, in terms of what happened with the Nazis and so forth. In other words, that idea of just being a citizen of the world and I can choose and pick proved to be not necessarily totally satisfactory. And in terms of what you've said, you're absolutely correct. I think that if any sort of folks, liberal Jews are going to survive, it is dependent on increased knowledge. But how do you justify that knowledge? After all, the Orthodox have a very strong sense as to why that should be. And then an extension of that is what you've said about Israel. Do you really feel that I, as a Jew, as an historical Jew, as somebody who's created in that situation, whether I willed it or not, that I'm going to be separated from the fate of Israel, whether I like it or not, whether it challenges me or not?
I'll answer three as we go down. First, the first one, again, I am not saying I agree with what these with what the Judaism, the new Exodus Judaism is becoming. I might argue with it. I'm just giving an analysis of what I think it is or is becoming. And yes, A, they do believe that they could be separated from Israel, and they don't feel that their destiny is tied, and they don't feel that Israel is necessary for their survival. Israel is actually that which is endangering their survival more than it is helping their survival. That's part of this new narrative. Two, they are very comfortable with a quasi-universal engagement within the context, but it's not, it doesn't give up on particularism, but it's very clear that there is a domain of responsibility and vision which transcends your Jewish, your personal Jewish identity. And one of the primary causes of that transformation is intermarriage itself. When the vast majority of Jews today, when the majority of Jewish children today are born from one Jewish parent, in their family itself is a multicultural, multinational identity already ingrained. Talk about your Zachor and Shamor, I guess like they're right in there from the beginning. There isn't the self-evidency of the particular, which is very different from the world that you grew up in. Very, very different. That was the third, the second. Remind me of the first, please.
Well, that was just you answered that to some extent.
Okay.
The idea of sort of universalist.
Okay, I thought that. Right. So it's, these are, this, you, it's, the right, these are trends that are increasingly evident, and they're just going to, and I, now again, as you look forward, what we have to do is look at where trends are going and what we need to do. There might be things that we're going to do that are going to reverse them. There might be other factors that will create a need to reverse this analysis. But this is, I believe, at least for the foreseeable future, the arena within which we have to prepare ourselves to function. Last question or comment, please.
Okay. There's a whole bunch of non-religious Jews. Which should have been left out of the conversation.
No, I said intentionally. I divided it. I was about to go into it, and then I looked at the time.
Okay.
And cruel and inhuman punishment is to lecture after the hour of 10.
Okay.
So, but if you would do, and maybe we'll do some of this tomorrow, we'll see, after lunch, but if you look at the Orthodox community, and you look at, if you'd like me to do that, and you're supposed to say, oh, please, please. But if you look at the Orthodox community, what does God, Torah, and Israel mean for them? It's also being significantly transformed and changed. And so I just spoke about what we got, I did half. The other part, you're right, it's a very different community, subjected to very, very different trends. In many ways, trends which are directly oppositional to this, something that is making the future of a united Jewish people extremely, extremely tenuous as we go forward. Yeah, but that would be, yes.
But, you know, my point on this was let's say they agree with what you said with respect to Genesis and Exodus Jews, except they cherry pick for themselves and then for others. What is it? What is Genesis and what is Exodus?
No. It's like, I would say they don't cherry pick necessarily. They believe that the Exodus Judaism being created by Genesis Jews is spiritual religious suicide, and as a result, they are taking extreme measures to ensure that something remains. But that's a story that I haven't told, and therefore we could talk about it further ourselves. But it would be for me to continue to answer you on a question which I haven't, and then I'm going to be tempted, I'm going to get into it, and then the time is getting late, and I want you all to be very awake when we come tomorrow. Have a wonderful evening. Shabbat Shalom.